This is The Impromptu, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. And now, your hosts for today, Michael Norton and me, Alex Knight.
Actually, Star Wars is a family soap opera, says George Lucas. Oh man, knowing that The Force Awakens is in no way what Lucas wanted to do just warms my heart. It's just like, yes. It's just like, yes, Star Wars is back.
Maybe we should tell the listeners exactly what you're referring to, since we started recording after.
Oh, you, yes. So Lucas, in an interview with CBS News, he basically said that Disney went in a direction he did not agree with. He explained that he felt Star Wars was really a family soap opera and, quote, not about the spaceships. And Disney decided to go in a different direction, which is just the greatest news ever. Because, as you may all be painfully aware, the prequel franchise was, how do I put this diplomatically, not excellent?
That's extremely diplomatic.
Yes.
That's very kind of you.
Yes, I know. It's a good thing we're not on a beach right now talking about this. Because I hate sand. It gets everywhere, and it's coarse, and I hate it.
I think it's great that, you're right. It is a good endorsement of The Force Awakens, because the fact that it goes against Lucas's own ideas, which generally have been really bad for a very, very long time, gives me a lot of hope about how this movie's actually going to turn out.
Being realistic, George Lucas is not a large part of what has made Star Wars good, traditionally. He had a lot of ideas, sure, but the original trilogy was largely successful due to the work of others who were put in place to manage George Lucas. The studios didn't trust him with their money. Like, they were making a big investment in these films, and George Lucas was unproven. Like, he had done some good films. He had done American Graffiti and THX 1138, but he hadn't done anything at the scope of Star Wars. So, he was under a lot more supervision than he was making the prequel trilogy. There were people telling him, no, George, that's a bad idea. No, George, let's do this instead. No, George, we're going to do this now.
He may have written the original screenplay.
Well,
but that's the thing.
He didn't even write a lot of it. His wife did. His first wife actually did a lot of revisions to the original script. So Star Wars Episode 4 was mostly written by George Lucas's first wife.
They were prequels. So Episodes 1, 2, and 3 were the ramblings of a lunatic.
Yeah, essentially. Because at that point, Star Wars was incredibly famous, and therefore George Lucas could do anything he wanted, and everyone would say, yes, George, that's great, George. Awesome, George. You're the best. And then we got what we got.
But Star Wars now, I mean, it's bigger than the creator, right? It's now...
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I really feel like Star Wars is a property that belongs to all of us.
Yeah, I think it's outgrown its creator at this point. A large part of the Star Wars fandom was the expanded universe that existed for years and years between trilogies and after the prequel trilogy as well. In fact, I would say the best thing to come out of the prequel trilogy was the animated series The Clone Wars, which Lucas was not involved in, that actually tried to repair some of the damage of the prequel movies and tried to tell a more compelling story about how Anakin fell to darkness and how all of these things went down. And in that series, an animated series, there was more chemistry between Anakin and Padme than in all of Attack of the Clones.
It's very telling, but, you know, one of the underlying themes of this show is that we've historically talked about a lot, not just about technology, but about how certain aspects of technology can have a significant impact on, as an example, and staying with filmmaking, how technology can have a large impact on storytelling, and looking at episodes 1, 2, and 3, which were so heavily CGI based.
Yeah.
And as we all know, CGI does not age well. And when you look at those movies now, I mean, I don't know if it's been at least 10 years since episode 3, but it's been a while, and those movies haven't aged well. And I think, you know, as great of a progress we've made with computer generated graphics, today, I think it's really telling that someone like J.J. Abrams has said, we're going to go back to basics. We're going to go back to how, as much as we possibly and physically can, we're going to go back to a time when we had to make do with what we had, meaning physical sets, like making full-size replicas of the Millennium Falcon, using props as much as possible, not just because it looks better, which it does, of course, but it's better for the actors to act and react to something that's physically right in front of them, as opposed to, look at this tennis ball on this pole in front of a green
screen.
Pretend
it's a giant tentacle monster and you're very scared.
Yeah. Exactly. It just doesn't work. So that's what makes me so excited about this movie. And I'm not the biggest Star Wars fan. I mean, I love Star Wars. I love the original trilogy and have no problem watching them again, but I'm not, like, my knowledge is not like as deep as yours. I mean, and just alone when the trailer first came out, the little teaser, you were pointing stuff out about the Millennium Falcon's dish that had been replaced, which was a clear reference to how it was damaged in the original, the last movie in the original trilogy or something like that.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that. I'm not that big of a Star Wars fan, clearly, but that's what makes me so excited about this is that we're going to get a movie that really, possibly for the longest time since the 70s, this is going to feel like a real Star Wars movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that George Lucas fundamentally misunderstood. He thought that CG was the answer to do all of this storytelling, but really it became a crutch for him because he just tried to pile on as much CG as possible, create these vast cityscapes and alien worlds that, to borrow Shakespeare, were full of sound and fury signifying nothing. It was just pageantry. None of it meant anything. It was just, oh, look at this cool stuff. Look at this cool stuff. And try to ignore the fact that there's no story, or at least not a good one. Because you don't notice how boring a trade dispute is if we've got lots of CG on the screen. I think a lot of what made Star Wars good was not only the chemistry between the characters, like a large part of it was that it was a character film. Like, you cared about what happened to these people. You cared about the relationships they were forming. Like, the romance between Han and Leia was crazy. Like, the way it just clearly built from episode 4 all the way through to the end. They hated each other. They annoyed each other. Slowly they built a rapport. Slowly the sparks started to fly until it culminated at the end of episode 5. I love you. I know. Like, 5 minutes of that was better than any storytelling done in the entire prequel trilogy. Show, but don't tell. And the other thing was, of course, the practical sets. Everything felt like it was real. Everything felt lived in, like it was a part of a larger universe. You didn't feel disconnected from everything. Like when the characters in the prequel trilogy were just flying past CG landscapes, it was just like, okay, whatever, more nonsense. But with the original series, they're running around the hallways of the Death Star, and you're like, oh shit, they're running around the hallways of the Death Star. This is a real place. Everything is real. It matters. Like it just kind of ties into that whole suspension of disbelief thing. When people are running around real sets, part of your brain feels like it's somehow real and you become more invested in the story and what's going on. But if you're looking at CG constantly, your brain goes, well, none of this is real. None of it matters. It's just CG nonsense. And that might not be entirely conscious, but your brain still registers it. So to audiences, practical effects feel more realistic than CG ever will. And CG can get as good and as amazing looking as you like, but it'll never truly replace practical effects in terms of realism. Because if you can make it look real for real, it sells it better than anything.
Do we know anything about how this movie's actually being shot with respect to the cameras? Like, are they using IMAX cameras?
They're using film. They're using real film, which is something J.J. Abrams felt strongly about, because real sets, real film, like, try to recapture the old feeling of the original series.
Yeah, Lucas was a big proponent of going digital for quite a while, so...
Oh, yeah.
Not that it's bad.
No,
but I see where he's coming from.
But I think there's actually a growing movement in Hollywood to sort of keep film around, because they've started phasing out a lot of the plants that make film, like Kodak and all those other companies. They've started closing plants, and film is harder and harder to come by. So budding filmmakers are kind of starting out with digital. And there have been several initiatives in Hollywood to try and save film and get people, when they're first learning, to use film. Because it is quite a robust medium. It's hard to describe, but it has a certain feel to it that you can't really replicate with digital. Like, digital is just too clean. It doesn't quite have the right grain to it that film does. You can always tell if something's shot digitally and if something's shot in film.
I love the clarity of a digital picture, because I mean, you know, seeing something that was shot on something like a 5K RED camera looks incredible.
Yeah,
but there's a certain clinical, cold sort of feeling to it, because it's so clean and there's so much detail.
It's stark.
It almost doesn't, like, it almost feels too real, which I don't like.
Yeah, it's actually funny how that works. It ties back to that idea of the uncanny valley. It's like, it looks too real, therefore it must be fake.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because now in software, there have been companies that make plugins to actually replicate the grain effect of celluloid.
So of course, it'll never
that. And it's like, why?
Just, it'll never get it
quite
right.
If you want that, shoot on 30mm. Yeah. Don't shoot digital.
Exactly. A plugin will never fully accurately reproduce what real film looks like. They can probably get it like 90% of the way there, but it'll never quite look the same just because of the way digital works, like digital encoding, all that other stuff. Like it'll never quite look right. And people pick up on that. Whether you think, oh, well, I can't tell the difference, people will. People absolutely will. And whether it's conscious or not, you just kind of feel like, well, that's not quite right. I think it's just one of these debates that's constantly going to go on for decades to come. Is digital better than real? Is real better than digital? What's right? What's wrong? I mean, ultimately, everything is just a tool that you use to tell a story. Sometimes you want to use digital. Sometimes you want to use film. Sometimes you want to use practical effects. Sometimes you want to use CG. The real wisdom in filmmaking comes from knowing when to use which thing.
I know people like Christopher Nolan are still such a huge proponent of shooting on film, but it's funny because there are pros and cons to the format. For example, with film, you can only film for so long on a single cartridge before you have to replace it, right? There's only so much film on a single cartridge, and usually you can get around, they'll shoot for, I think, anywhere from 7 to 10 minutes, which seems crazy, but with digital, you're only limited by the amount of storage that you have. So you could film for a long time, but interestingly, I've heard from filmmakers who still shoot on film that they actually like that restraint. Having that old school restraint of, I can only shoot this scene for a certain amount of minutes before I have to move on. And I think there's something to be said for that. And it kind of reminds me of Twitter, actually. It's like, yes, it's so limiting to have 140 characters, but it really makes you think carefully about what you're going to say.
Exactly. It's kind of like the camera roll on your phone versus a Polaroid. With a Polaroid, you only have so many shots, and then it's spent.
They're expensive, too.
Yeah. So you really have to take photos that matter to you. Whereas with a phone, it's just like, oh, whatever, I'll take 50 shots of that bird, and then I'll keep the ones I like and delete the ones I don't, whatever. And it's the same with film versus digital. Film, you have to shoot content that matters. You have to think it through and be precise and careful. With digital, it's like, oh, whatever, we'll edit it in post. It allows for an ease. It allows for a lack of caring that isn't present when you use manual tools. Because if everything's just bits and bytes, then, your only limit is storage, and you can shoot as much as you want, and you can do 6,000 takes of a particular thing and use the one that's best. But by doing things that way, it kind of makes it more robotic. It makes it more clinical, more sterile, because maybe in the 5,398th shot, he does this one thing perfect, but in another shot, the only one, something entirely unique happens and it really works. But because you've got this other one where it's perfect, you're like, okay, cool, we'll use that one instead. But if you shot with film, maybe you use that take because it was the last one and the best one. And it makes for a better film because it feels more organic that way.
Right. Maybe you know more about this than I do, but something we've talked about before is on previous episodes have been 4K and why it's still a few years away from really taking off, for a variety of reasons. But, I was actually just thinking how shooting on film affects the end result of the product that consumer gets in their hands. So, for example, I'm just wondering about what the practical differences are in terms of like noticeable detail between, say, a movie. I guess we're going to be talking about Blu-rays here. So let's say a movie that's been remastered in, from its original source film material in 2K versus a 4K remaster, like how much detail can you get out of the actual film, and is it noticeable?
So the original film is technically at an 8K resolution. Like film itself is quite dense.
Okay, so that, yeah, that you just answered my question, because that was always the one thing that was looming over my mind. Like, I never really knew, like, how much detail can you actually capture with film?
Yeah, it's pretty dense.
So we're losing a lot then, even on current Blu-rays, we're losing a lot of detail.
Yeah, definitely. So film starts at 8K, and I don't know if this is a recent thing or it's always been 8K, but it's always been quite densely packed. And film, in cinemas, the film screens have always been 8K. Like, it's not 4K or 1080p, it's 8K.
Well, I mean, we're obviously right smack dab in the middle of trying to make at least inroads into transitioning from 1080p to 4K, but why jump to 4K? Why didn't we just go to straight to 6K or 8K?
I think the problem there is just the file size required. Because, of course, film is film. It takes up physical space, but the resolution is indeterminate. Like, that doesn't have any bearing on the actual size of the film. Like, you have this large reel, and that's a 2.5-hour film. It doesn't matter. It's still as sharp as the day it was shot. There's no degradation in quality. But with digital, the resolution matters in terms of, okay, how much footage can I actually fill on this hard drive? So 4K is very expensive in terms of storage. Even just 4K is incredibly vast. The video compression algorithms, the codecs, haven't really caught up yet. They're still quite unoptimized for extremely high resolution footage. There are new formats that are sort of there. There's HEVC, there's MP5. I'm not sure exactly what they're doing. There's H.265. That's the, MP4 codec for 4K. I don't know if they're using a different file name for it, but it's more optimized. I wouldn't say it's extremely optimized. You're basically going to get similar file size constraints to the 6S. A few minutes of 4K is going to be like 500 megabytes to a gigabyte. Before you know it, you've completely filled up an entire hard drive. Like, the RED camera that you mentioned earlier, it actually has swappable hard drive bays, because every however many minutes of footage you shoot, you actually have to swap out the hard drive for a fresh one.
Wow.
Because it fills it up.
And I can only assume that there's vast more processing resources involved.
Oh, yeah.
On an image like that.
To edit 4K video, you essentially need a Mac Pro or better, basically. Especially if you're dealing with a lot of it and you need to like do crossfades and cuts, and like to do any kind of really complicated video editing, like for a movie, you need top of the line hardware for 4K. So to go to 8K is it's going to be extremely difficult. And then you have to double that complexity when we're talking about TV, because TV is just at 1080p right now. To then ask them to essentially quadruple the resolution, they're going to have to tear everything out, replace it with brand new cutting edge hardware. It's just not possible right now. They would essentially have to build media servers in every studio just to store the 4K footage that they're shooting. I don't think it's really technically feasible right now on that scale, just because of the data storage requirements. Cause we'd be talking like probably petabytes a month, possibly more. Just from shooting 4K video for TV shows every day, every other day, like it would be an order of magnitude more data than what they're doing now. So it would be a huge investment, and I don't even know if they could build storage tech that would satisfy their needs at the present time. Like, we probably need hard drives that are twice as big as they are now. Like, right now, the biggest hard drive you can buy is probably 8 terabytes. We're going to need, like, 50-terabyte hard drives, 100-terabyte hard drives. They're working on it. They're almost there. But, yeah, we need to kind of get to that next level before this really becomes feasible.
Tons of technical hurdles involved. It's very interesting. Yeah, you know, it's the other interesting switch that's going to... Well, it's going to have to happen at some point, but the and we kind of touched on that previously about how, like, how do over the air broadcasts work over 4K? I mean, that's just insane.
They don't. You would need. Sorry. Yeah, you would need a signal transmitter the size of the moon, like
the size of the Death Star.
Death Star, yes, a 4K mega laser. Broadcast. Tonight's program brought to you by 4K Mega Laser. Beam directly into your home. Do not look directly at the Mega Laser. Yeah, it. I don't think you could do it with today's radio technology. Like, the gain you would need to have to transmit that kind of signal bandwidth just would not be possible. You would just, like, they would have to construct massive radio towers in the center of every city, and even then...
What's the big deal, Michael? They should just get on that tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
Did you have one more thing to add about that?
No, I don't think I have anything else. It's like, yeah, radio broadcast. It's just like, yeah, radio broadcasts won't work. If we're going to get to 4K, it's going to be cable only.
Yeah. And speaking of cable, actually, huge news today posted on the CBC coming directly from the CRTC, which Canadians will be well aware of. But the CRTC... has some say over what communication companies can and cannot do. And a few years back, they put the kibosh on 3 years long cell phone contracts. And everyone, of course, was super happy about this. Now, of course, Canada, I feel like Canada's always catching up to the rest of the world. I mean, the U.S. has had 2 year contracts for quite a while. And I don't even know if contracts are a thing in Europe. Like, are there 2 year cable contracts? I don't think there are.
I don't think so. I think it's pretty much prepaid and bring your own phone.
Like, I know in France, because I obviously I work with someone who lives in France, and things like cable are subsidized by the government. You can have like $60 a month, you can have a kick-ass internet and mobile phone plan. Like, yeah. That's incredible. That would never happen here. But anyways.
Unfortunately.
I'm veering away from this slightly, but the announcement is that that a $25 basic cable package must be in place by March 1, and that's a mandate coming directly from the CRT. This is a huge deal. Now, I am not a person who is a cable TV subscriber, mainly because for a variety of reasons I don't want to get into, but I think they're pretty obvious. But this is a big deal because, as we all know, there isn't a ton of competition in this country, and there's a monopoly over it, and they can just pretty much charge whatever they want, and people will pay it, because, let's face it, most people aren't quite ready to cut the cord, so to speak, yet, because there are so many things like live broadcasts that people just really want to see it. And not just live broadcasts and like things like sports, but some people don't want to wait for TV shows to land on Netflix, which is totally understandable because it can take anywhere from 6 months to a year for them to sign some kind of license deal, you know, to get that stuff. So, you know, this is a big deal. But a $25 basic cable package is going to make a big difference to a lot of Canadians, and they're imposing some limitations on what kind of stuff that you will have to include. Now, I'm just going to read this a little bit from the CBC article, because I thought this was actually interesting on the topic of diversity, which we've covered on the show as well. But they're saying that the basic package, and I quote, the basic package must include channels on the CRTC's mandatory distribution list, including CBC, CTV, and Global, and Aboriginal and minority English or French channel, French language channels. In addition, a group of U.S. channels could be included, usually CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, and non-commercial channel PBS. At least 10 of the channels must be local or regional, including the community channel and the proceedings of the provincial legislator, if available. So that sounds pretty promising to me.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's certainly not bad. The problem, I think, comes in with the other part of the announcement, which is that additionally, cable companies now have to provide different packages, which are essentially choose and swap which channels you actually want.
More
additionally,
closer to an a la carte model.
Yeah, it's essentially they've essentially mandated sort of an a la carte model, but also with smaller bundles, like these channels for 10 extra bucks a month, these channels for 25 extra bucks a month, that sort of thing. The only problem there, as has been pointed out, is that with this model, I don't know if this is so much, it's hard to say if this is really a problem or not. I mean, it's a problem for some people, but the argument is basically that channels that people don't watch will essentially get bled dry and die out, or channels that not enough people watch. That's kind of the argument. And in some cases, I don't see that as a huge problem because I feel like there's way too many channels on TV.
There's way too many, and there's too much junk.
People just don't care. But on the other hand, there are some channels where they're doing something important and you don't necessarily want them to go off the air, but they might, because not a lot of people watch it, like not at the numbers of, say, HBO or Showtime. There are smaller channels out there that are more niche that have a dedicated following, but not at the numbers where suddenly cutting off subsidies would allow them to survive.
Honestly, I can't see why anyone would need... I mean, I could probably count the channels on both hands. Like, why would you need more than... I mean... I'll try and name some. So, you know, at least if there's some good programs on daytime TV, obviously, like Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show and stuff like NBC. Let's say NBC, ABC, CBS. And then you got your AMC, your HBO, your Showtime, BBC, perhaps, Sci-Fi Channel, which has some unique programming. And that covers a lot of bases. Am I right? I mean, other than sports and cooking, maybe.
Yeah, the only thing is, without subsidies, channels can't get started, essentially. It's like, right now, if somebody wants to make a TV channel, they pitch it to the various telecoms. And if a telecom goes, oh yeah, that sounds cool, then they'll just add it to their programming, and they get money from all the telecoms that carry it. Because it becomes part of somebody's cable subscription. So part of that money goes to the channel to keep it running. So if suddenly you say, okay, now we're going to move to a model where people choose the channels they want and that's it, then you have to rely on getting viewers, lots and lots and lots of viewers to survive. And so the argument is some channels that might actually be really good can't get off the ground because that initial safety net isn't there to find an audience. So it could stifle creativity.
And there's the other argument too that I see from the consumer perspective, that this sort of the unbundling of cable is better for the consumer, but also means that realistically, if you're going to be paying per channel, you're going to end up spending more than what you did, which is very possible.
Yeah.
Realistically, though, I'm not so sure that's actually going to happen, because I think what would happen is I think once somebody cancels their cable subscription and buys something like an Apple TV. This is all theoretical. That imagine a future where you buy an Apple TV or any kind of media box like that, where you can just, you don't need a cable subscription. You sign up and you pay per individual channel. I think what people are going to find is suddenly those 300 or 400 channels that they had before, they're going to find out the ones that they really only care about are probably going to be in the range of 10 to 20 channels. So if they're priced at, say, $5 a channel, you're not going to be spending that much money. Now, I'm not saying that they price it that low at $5 a channel. Even if it's $10 or $15 per channel, you know, you're going to whittle it down, and you're going to find that you really don't care about that many channels.
Yeah. Ultimately,
because that's what happens when you throw with cable TV, you just throw hundreds of channels at people. They're going to suddenly, when they have access to that much, they're going to think, wow, I have access to all this amazing stuff. I care about all of this stuff. And it just isn't the case. It's like streaming music. Yes, it's so fantastic. $10 a month, I get access to endless amounts of music. But in reality, I don't really listen to that much of it. And my music library is really, really tiny. Like, I like what I like, and I do like finding new artists, but it's like, there are millions of songs in iTunes. I don't listen to millions of songs, so it doesn't matter.
Amusingly, it kind of goes back to that digital versus analog thing, because, if you have to buy every album, you're only going to pick albums that are really good. You're only going to pick things that you really want. But with streaming, it's like, oh, whatever, I get this for free anyway. Well, not for free, but like, I get all of this for $10 a month. What do I care? I'll just add it to my library. No big deal.
And I'd actually argue, and I can speak from my personal experience, because I've had cable TV before. Even though I have access to way less on something like Netflix. Actually, let's just use iTunes as an example. There's tons of stuff on iTunes, but I have to pay for each individual item, unlike my cable TV subscription.
Yeah.
But what I found was I'm way more selective. And I think that's what would happen with somebody who would shift from a cable subscription to pay per individual channel, is that you're gonna suddenly realize that you didn't need all of that in the first place.
Yeah, pretty much. You're only gonna go with what you really care about watching. So for most people, that's honestly just going to be AMC and HBO.
I'd also argue that you're going to end up watching more. And I know for me, I end up watching more TV and movies on Netflix and iTunes, even though it may be more expensive to buy them, say, individually on, let's say, iTunes. It's because I'm picky. And I now don't have access to unlimited amounts of media. I have to carefully look at what I'm going to buy, but I end up buying more anyways. Just because it's like all this stuff goes ignored. Out of 300 channels, I maybe only watch 10 or 20 different channels. I mean, and there are only so many hours in the week available, so it's all useless to me.
Yeah, and that's kind of where these arguments come from. But at the same time, I kind of think, well, if people want to put out new content, just go to the channels that are still around. Like if people are funneling all of their money into the channels they really care about, then those channels will likely have more money to buy new shows in the first place. In theory, anyway. So, I think new creative content will find a way, per se. Like, instead of having 50 different cooking channels, there will be one channel. Like, the Food Network will probably still be around. And if everybody subscribes to that, then they'll likely have enough money to add more shows. So if somebody has a really good idea for a cooking show, they'll hopefully be able to pitch it and get it on the channel. This is all kind of idealized. Nothing says that this is how it's actually going to play out. It's entirely possible that moving to this model may stifle creativity because the telecoms might just pocket the money. Like, it might not be that these these few surviving channels end up getting more money out of this. They might end up with the same amount of money, and then all these other channels die, and there's a bunch of ideas out there for shows that never happen because you've essentially thinned the herd. There's nowhere to go. There's just these few fat cows grazing in a pasture, and across the road is a barren wasteland littered with the corpses of channels that nobody watched. So, I mean, it could go that way too. But it's hard to say without it actually going forward.
What's really interesting to me is, I'm just going to put this out there. How would this work in a world where there are no cable? Let's assume cable TV remains for a number of years, but it slowly evolves away from this bundling model and moves to a more a la carte model. Is it possible for cable TV to survive without mandatory contracts? Well, actually, I guess it's, I mean,
I think you can sign up now
without, you can go month to month without a contract, but they strongly encourage it. Obviously,
I think
they give you better deals. Everything's more, it's heavily subsidized, right?
Yeah. I think as it exists, cable TV will disappear. It will no longer be as we know it. I think essentially every channel is going to evolve into a production company. And those production companies will all create content for the various streaming services that exist. So Apple TV, Android TV, Amazon Fire TV, all of these will be gateways to content. And
so the studios are effectively what, Amazon and Netflix?
Yeah, essentially. So what used to be a channel is now a content provider. And Amazon, Apple, Google, whoever else, they're the gatekeepers. They get the content from the content providers and deliver it to the consumer.
So what happens to big companies like TELUS and Bell in Canada?
They become dumb pipes of data, whether
Comcast,
they like it or not.
And all these other companies. So how would they survive, or could they even survive?
They'll survive, but
I guess they would survive. I mean, they still make their revenue is the revenue split between cable TV and mobile. I mean, mobile's still big, so that would be around.
Yeah. What'll essentially happen to them is they'll become dumb providers of data,
right,
which they really don't want to happen,
so
but it's going to happen.
Just the pipe. They're providing the bandwidth.
They'll be a pipe. And they don't like that idea, but it's going to happen whether they like it or not. That's just where things are headed.
I think so, too. I think it's very clear that's the direction we're slowly, I mean, very slowly
inching
towards.
They're going kicking and screaming.
Yeah.
They do not want this to happen at all, because then you're just paying them like $50 a month for this many gigs, and that's it. They can't give you add-ons. They can't give you packages. It's just this much cold hard cash for this much data, and that's it.
I guess my next question is, will the CRTC get involved with data caps? Because that's the next big issue.
I hope
we do, because we're in a very interesting transitional state we're moving from these bundled subsidized models to these unsubsidized models where people have a choice. But the biggest roadblock that I see is the bandwidth that these companies are imposing on people. And frankly, 500 gigabytes a month is not going to cut it.
No.
Even, okay, 5-10 years from now, when cable TV has gone away, there is no way, like, if the world looks like how you're describing it now, saying that Amazon, Google, Apple, Netflix, these guys are like the gateways, they become effectively like the studios. Like, that world can't exist with these minuscule data caps.
No, it can't.
So something's going to have to break, and someone's going to have to force their hand. And that, I can only see the CRTC being the one to do that. Because they're not going to willingly lift their bandwidth caps.
As far as they're concerned, like, they continue to preach the lie that, oh, we have to impose bandwidth limits or we'll run out of internet. Like,
you've reached the end of the internet.
Yeah.
Please turn around.
It's an old lie, and it's one they keep telling. It's complete and utter bullshit, but they continue saying it, and they hope that if they say it enough times, everyone will believe them. But of course, we know that it's completely untrue. Their networks are built of stronger stuff than that. They can handle so many concurrent users. It doesn't matter.
They've all started laying fiber too, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Eventually everything's going to be fiber. And I'm sorry, but yeah, that age-old statement just doesn't hold water anymore.
No.
Like,
It hasn't for a long time.
It hasn't for a long time, and especially now. You know, with ridiculous at this point.
Ultimately, I feel that data access just needs to be a public utility like electricity. Yeah. That's really what we need to move to, and that's probably what scares them the most. Because a lot of European countries are now mandating that access to internet is a human right, and they have initiated programs that are basically intended to give every one of their citizens gigabit Ethernet by 2020. I know Sweden and Finland are working on things like that. So it's only a matter of time before that kind of sweeps across the first world, where it's like, okay, everybody needs the internet. It's about time we did something about making sure that everybody has it.
Yeah.
So
like, it wouldn't be hard for, okay, I know you can't, it seems crazy to even suggest this because we're all nerds and we all have super high bandwidth, but you can't, like, being on a 5 megabits per second connection is kind of crappy these days, and I think 10 megabits per second is the recommended minimum to run HD on Netflix.
Yeah.
But I think it's very feasible that, like, in the future we get to a point where the CRTC says, okay, 5 megabits per second is now free for everyone in this country. It is a right that at a minimum everybody needs to have 5 megabits per second, because without the internet now, I mean, I can't even imagine
it would be
10 years from now, somebody without, like, someone who cannot afford to have internet access, like, you're already so disadvantaged. And of course, yes, you can go to the public library. Yeah, I know that. It's not the same as having access to it all the time.
No, it's not. They could do that, but I just feel like 5 is just too slow. Like, especially 5, 10 years
from now. I
pulled
that out of my butt, but like, I don't know what number in terms of, like, what is a realistic number, or does it even matter? Could they supply everyone in Canada with 10 megabits? Could TELUS give everyone 10 megabits per second
easily
available for free?
Easily.
Without any, they've got the infrastructure. The wires are there.
Yeah.
There's no reason other than wanting to make a buck from an individual. There's no reason why they can't do that.
No. There's no technical reason. They could easily provide free internet to everyone at this point. It's that the infrastructure is that dense. Like, you could just flip a switch and everybody could have free internet. In theory, the people like you and I paying for way more bandwidth and way more speed would subsidize the free internet for everyone else.
Exactly. So that's how you do it.
It in the long run, that would be a better model. But of course, the big problem with a lot of these companies is they think short-term profits over long-term gains. That's how all corporations are wired to think these days. Nobody thinks about, oh, in 20 years, we can have this many subscribers and make this much money. No, we think, oh, what about our next quarterly earnings call? Like, there's no consideration of what can we do now to make things better then.
Well,
they're
not going to do this willingly.
No,
some organizational body will have to put the hammer down and say, this is now, like, you know, maybe the Trudeau government will help put a bill through
I could see them doing that. Obviously it's not going to be high on their current priorities list, but I could see it being possible to petition them about it, to at least bring it up for discussion.
I feel like it's, and I don't know if it'll happen with the current regime, but I feel like within the next 10 years, it's it's a likely possibility that we may see something like a basic, like, internet plan as a human rights thing that you need to have.
Yeah, it's totally possible.
You know, speaking of data caps, it's interesting that a lot, at least here anyways, I don't know about the US, but big internet service providers, like in Canada, we have TELUS, which is the largest, as far as I know, between them and Bell. Anyways, I think TELUS owns more infrastructure. But anyway, you know, these companies, these big ISPs have started to offer these unlimited data plans, not for free, of course, you have to pay them. I think it's like an extra $30 or something like that. You can have unlimited data, although I'm sure there's probably a little asterisk in tiny, tiny, tiny font that says, you know, like, you know, fair usage, you know, where they, it's not, it's unlimited, but it's not unlimited really. But I don't know what that means exactly. I'm going to have to look into that. But I find that really interesting that they've started to at least, even though you have to, it sucks that you have to pay for it, but at least they're acknowledging that, yes, more and more people are using a shitload of data.
Yeah, it's just going to become more and more of a problem as time goes on, especially when you have companies like Apple going, oh yeah, the base level of our iPhone is still 16 gigs. Guess you'd better stream a lot of stuff.
Oh, why'd you have to bring that up?
Well, hey, that's definitely a contributing factor. If you can only store so much on your phone, you're going to end up streaming more, and that's going to cut into your bandwidth. So, yeah, this is just going to become more and more of an issue, especially, again, going back to 4K. Like, 4K just cannot happen if we only have 500 gigs a month. Like, you would tear that to shreds watching half a season of House of Cards in 4K.
Well, there's no doubt by the time I upgrade my TV to a 4K, I'm going to have to spend more on the unlimited plan because there's just no way.
Yeah. And the thing with these unlimited plans, it used to be truly unlimited. Like, AT&T's unlimited plan was unlimited, the one that some people are still luckily grandfathered into, but they're trying to like phase it out slowly. The new unlimited plans that have been introduced around, like T-Mobile and Wind here in Canada, the way they've been doing it is you have this many gigabytes and then we start throttling your speed. So it's unlimited, but at the same time, it's not unlimited because you only have so many gigs of data before they start slowing it down. And sure, it's probably not that bad, but if you're used to a certain speed of internet for whatever purpose you're using it for, to have it suddenly slow down on you, it sucks.
I have a 500 gigabyte cap though. And I basically every month now, I hit, like, I go right up to the limit.
If that's happening to you now, imagine what it's going to be like a few years from now when you're streaming everything. Chaos. Utter chaos.
Why? I am pretty much streaming everything.
Yeah.
I only use Netflix. I don't buy stuff off of iTunes.
So then a few years you're streaming 4K now.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's just like, you know, once I get a 4K TV, the shows that do have it are going to just kill my bandwidth.
It'll realistically only take a few episodes before it's like, yeah.
That's what pisses me off about these companies because, you know, a company like, who owns ShowMe? Is it Shaw?
No, ShowMe is, I don't think Shaw is actually doing any of that. They're just perfectly content to let Netflix do their thing, I believe.
It's owned by Rogers and Shaw.
Oh, wow.
So I was right. So, that's the thing. Is if you're, let's say, a Shaw internet customer and they give you 500 gigabytes, right? Now, of course, something like Netflix is going to count against your data cap. But, of course, what they're going to do is they're going to be like, well, you know, you wouldn't have this problem if you use our streaming service because it obviously doesn't count. That's what's so nefarious about this.
These companies
are creating their own streaming services to compete with Netflix, and they don't count against your data.
I'm not sure. I think they've been forced to make it count because they have to sell it to anyone regardless of if they subscribe or not. Because originally it was only available for customers of that telecom, and the CRTC ruled that they had to make it available to everyone in Canada. Cutting the cord, that becomes a concern.
And I recently considered, of course, I considered going to a cable subscription as well. Now they have bundles. So let's look at what they actually offer. So right now, TELUS is advertising a $50 a month package for internet TV. That sounds pretty good, right? $50 a month. I mean, I'm paying $100 a month right now just for internet. Yeah. Okay. But when you actually look at it, in the details, it says, okay, free TV hardware rental, $25 per month value, and built-in home Wi-Fi, 3 months of Crave TV, which I think is owned by TELUS. So $50 a month, you get internet 25, which is 25 megabits per second down, which is not great, but not bad. That's totally usable. And I think it's 5 or 10 megabits up or something like that. Mm. But the problem is, of course, if I want to keep my 100 megabits per second in a bundle, I'll have to end up spending way more. And the cable plan will be like, it'll add another, I think, $65 or $70 on my bill. And I'm sorry, I'm not paying $180 a month for internet and cable TV.
Yeah, it's pretty absurd. And
like, I already spend $100 a month on my phone and $100 a month on internet. And it's hard to justify even $100 a month on a phone when I work from home and I'm on Wi-Fi most of the time. Like, why am I spending this? I don't make phone calls. Like, my money is going down the toilet, but I need a phone. So it's like, I can go to one of these cheaper providers like Wynn, and I always reevaluate their network. As they continually, very slowly improve it, but
they're trying. They're really trying.
Every time I try their network, it's so bad, and they don't have LTE available. So it's like, once you get spoiled on like LTE speeds of like 70 megabits per second and faster, which is more than what most people have, even in their home for internet, it's like going to a 6 to 10 megabits per second download is so painful. Anyways, you want to wrap it up? It's been an hour. Thanks for listening to another episode of The Impromptu. I'm here with Michael Norton, as always, and I'm Alex Knight. If you have a moment, please do take a sec to open up iTunes and give us a rating. We would sincerely appreciate it. It helps new listeners find our show. If you'd like to reach out to either of us, you can send us some feedback at theimpromptu.net/contact. We also have a donation page available as well if you want to donate a buck or two, which really helps us out. You can also reach us on Twitter at The Impromptu, and we're a weekly show-ish. We'd be more weekly usual than what we used to be anyways.
On that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.